Well, good evening. And I, on behalf of the London Metropolitan University, the Freud Museum, the Institute of Psychoanalysis, the Women's Therapy Centre, and the Rowan Arts Project, I'd like to welcome you to this Connecting Conversations this evening. Connecting Conversations is intended to forge links between psychoanalysis and other disciplines. We're delighted tonight to have with us Sally Vickers in conversation with Michael Parsons. Let me just briefly introduce the two. Sally Vickers, well, she's known to all of you as a writer of a number of novels. Her first novel was Miss Garnett's Angel, which became known, as she says, as a word-of-mouth bestseller. She puts it like this, i.e. a book on which the publisher wouldn't spend any money.
That was a private note.
Sally has worked as a university teacher of literature in adult education and as a Jungian psychotherapist, and now works full-time as a writer. She's written a number of novels, and most recently one that many of you will be familiar with, The Other Side of You. And of course her most recent piece is Where the Three Roads Meet in the Canongate series of myths. Michael Parsons is a training analyst at the British Psychoanalytic Society. Before training as a doctor and a psychoanalyst, he studied classics and philosophy. He has a particular interest in the relationship between psychoanalysis and literature, also, I have to note, between psychoanalysis and religion. And he may be well known to some as the author of The Dove That Returns, The Dove That Vanishes, Paradox and Creativity in Psychoanalysis. So I think even from the brief biographies, we can see that there may well be tremendous links between the two, and I think we can welcome the two of them and expect a very interesting discussion. The discussion between the two of them will last for 45 minutes, and then we'll invite the audience to speak. Thank you.
Well, Sally, it's good to have arrived finally at this moment. I was very pleased when you asked if I'd do this with you. I thought that we could have some fun together. And thank you particularly for being here, because I should say Sally's just been telling Rosemary and me that, you know, as you know, when authors bring out a new book, there's a grueling round of interviews and discussions. And Sally was saying she's had something every evening this week. With the last two, one was in Edinburgh, one was in Northumberland. So I think it's brilliant that you're managing to be here at all.
Much more difficult to get to the Holloway Road, actually, than Edinburgh.
I wondered about so many different ways that we might start off, because there's so much that I want to talk to you about. I'm sure we shan't get it all into our 45 minutes. Your journey to what you're doing at the moment has been interesting. And although it's really your work, it's your writing that I'd most like to talk about, I thought it might be interesting to start by just asking you about your journey from being a teacher of English literature to a Jungian analyst, now being somebody who makes literature yourself, a teller of stories. It's a very interesting trajectory. I saw in an interview in one of the backs of the books that you said you'd become a teacher of English literature because you weren't trained to do anything else. I couldn't help noticing a remark at the beginning, near the beginning of The Other Side of You. And I do know that characters in the book are characters and they're not you speaking through them. So, you know, because I'm going to cheat slightly, but just so I want to say, I do know that. But the psychiatrist in that book says that I've always found solace in immersing myself in others' lives and worlds. It was therefore natural that my first degree should be in English literature. I just couldn't help noticing that remark.
Well, of course, you're trained to notice that.
I wondered
these bits that slip out.
I wondered if you wanted to say something about how you got from A to B to C.
I can try, But almost everything I've done in my life has happened without plan. I read English literature. I say I read English literature. Mostly I was reading Woman's Own at the time. And then, you know, equally without plan, I had my first child, swiftly followed by my second child. We used to say we were practicing birth control. And that's why I wasn't really equipped to do anything else, because I had a degree in English literature. In those days, you could, you know, do pretty much with an English degree. And so I really slid into it as a way of just earning some money. And also because I do love English literature, there's no doubt about that. Similarly, when I went on to work in adult education, that was when the children were a bit older and I wanted to be around with them, and so I used to work in the evenings. But truth to tell, I terrified the secondary school which I went to by when they interviewed me for I got a state scholarship there. When they interviewed me, they asked what I wanted to do, and I said, and I do have evidence for this, I must have said it, I wanted to be a psychoanalyst. So I think the idea that I would eventually work in something like the profession I ended up in prior to being a writer was always around in my mind. And as a matter of fact, I first wanted to be a child psychotherapist. Mm. It was only when I had my own children that I changed my mind. But you're right, actually. I mean, it always irritates me when people ascribe to my characters my points of view. There's actually nothing more irritating to an author to hear the view of somebody you feel you have carefully evolved to be as unlike you as possible, suddenly attributed to you, and usually you're being taken to task for it, you know, on such occasions. And I like to say that none of my characters are autobiographical, but there is a sense in which they're all autobiographical, because I think all real characters come out of different elements in our own psyche. And you, with your eagle eye, Michael, have picked up a bit of David McBride, which I think I have to confess and say is an autobiographical element. The reading element that he confesses to was always mine. It was always my passion.
I mean, one can see the reading in the first novel that you wrote. I mean, it's interesting. I think there's always a work of art connected to your novels, sometimes more in the background, like Hamlet in number 3, or Sophocles in... which is it, the other one that I'm thinking? Yes, the Book of Job in Mr. Golightly's Holiday. But sometimes there's a work of literature or art that really drives the novel. Mm. And that's true in your first book. I mean, it's interesting, having found your way rather gradually towards being a writer, there's nothing provisional about that first novel. It's very ambitious, formally, rewriting a book of the Bible in your own voice, separate typeface running through the book. There's a feeling of you knowing very much what you're doing. And it seems as though already there was a strong sense of purpose about what you wanted to explore.
Yes, when I produced Miss Garnett's Angel, I didn't know this at the time, but I was considered terribly elderly to be a first-time writer, because at the time there was a sort of phase, which may well still be continuing, I fear, of generally wanting to accept manuscripts and ongoing contracts with rather younger writers, the idea being that people were only interested in the young. And that is a trend, you know, in publishing. You know, it's significantly harder to get a book published over the age of 40, and I was a good way over the age of 40. In fact, I was older than George Eliot was when she had her first novel published, and for a long time she was my sort of ideal. But I outstripped her in the geriatric stakes. So in a way, I was immensely lucky that they accepted it at all. And the subject was also considered somewhat unfashionable, hence my sly remark about the publishers being unwilling to spend any money whatsoever on it, which actually worked in my favour ultimately. I was lucky. But I also think I was lucky because how will I put this? I used to play as a child at being a writer. I would put together bits of paper and make them into a book and write what I considered to be novels. And I actually wrote my first novel at the age of 9. I had a rather enlightened primary school teacher who noticed I spent rather a lot of time looking out of the window. And then rather than tick me off, he put me and another pupil whose name was Christina Slapakora. I've always wondered what happened to her. And we both sat on our own in a classroom, would never be allowed nowadays, and wrote novels. Most enterprising. And interestingly, mine had a sort of pattern which rather was really the harbinger of the pattern of everything I've written since. It was called The Door into Time. It was about 4 children who were orphaned. See, death right at the beginning always comes in. They go and stay with a guardian who lives in the country and neglects them in the best possible way. And then they come across a sundial with a wonky top and a tortoise. And when the tortoise and the sundial get into alignment, time opens and they walk through it. Well, basically, I've been writing the same book ever since. But anyway, to come back to what your original question was, by the time I wrote Miss Garnet, I really had, if I say it was easy, it was surprisingly easy because I had so much stored up in my mind that I wanted to write about. I had the marvellous location of Venice, which I knew very well, the remarkable painting by Guardi of the story of Tobias and the Angel, and the story, which I also knew very well. And to use that marvellous phrase of Keats, something dovetailed in my mind, and it sort of flowed out fairly uninterrupted. I mean, it's pretty unrewritten, Miss Garnet.
I'm so interested in the title of your first novel,
The Door into Time.
The Door into Time, and you've been writing the same book ever since.
I'm afraid so, but
it strikes me so much because, you know, I've noted down things from all through your books, and there's a moment late on in The Other Side of You where David Bride is in Rome looking at the Caravaggio paintings that are another of these driving elements in the work, like the Book of Tobit is in Miss Garnet, and he's in a church, and Sally writes, "A church from long tradition offers even strangers to worship a rest from the press of the world. And as I didn't fancy fighting through the mass of communists again, a street demonstration, and had time on my hands, I sat in the vaulted quiet reflecting on the Caravaggios. What they so strikingly offered was access to those moments which invade time and contain both its annihilation and renewal." About that. I mean, you have been writing the same book ever since, haven't you?
Just before we came out here, we were talking, and I was describing to Michael how a few weeks ago I went to an event not too dissimilar from this, and somebody read out a piece of my work, and I utterly failed to recognise it. I didn't fail to recognise that, but I would not have remembered quite how I put it. So it is very interesting. Yes, I think I've always had a fascination with time, as you can tell from The Door into Time, and that has continued. Yes, I've always been interested in the way in which, any work of art, but I suppose particularly a story, because I think stories are the most sort of adaptable forms of art. They're the most evolutionary forms of art. Both exist within a particular civilization and a particular location in time and outstrip it. And as they outstrip it, as they move through time, they acquire elements of other times which they're moving through, And also they acquire something from the people who hear them or listen to them or read them, which is a very interesting thing. And that whole process is something I've always been interested in.
It links to something I was thinking about. You know, I've thought a lot about themes which run through your work. And I think one could say that very, very evidently, Miss Garnett's Angel is about transformation of in Miss Garnett. Miss Garnett is a retired school teacher of a recognisably inhibited, rather dried up spinster type. And the novel portrays her transformation. She going to Venice and through various encounterings there, she discovers excitement, beauty, passion, love, a kind of emotionality that she's had no sense of before. I think it's a wonderfully described change and development in a character.
And I think crucially disappointment, because I think one of the points I don't consciously make, but I think the book makes, and I make a distinction between what I do and what the book does. None of those things would have occurred without the initial trauma of a loss and the secondary trauma of the loss of a promised or presumed affection.
Like with David McBride in The Other Side of You, it's the loss of his brother Jonathan, which is the tragedy that's pervaded his life. But without that, he couldn't undergo the transformation that happens to him when the interaction with his patient makes him undo the repression and discover a real memory about what happened, and that transforms his life.
Yes, I think there's always something in the books about loss and its relationship to transformation, though, of course, as you will be particularly aware, and I should think everyone in this room is aware, it's such an easy thing to be glib about. I mean, we need to be a bit careful about the sort of, you know, trauma leading to transformation cliché. And I'm happy to see Miss Garnett's Angel as a book about transformation, but I'm also conscious or hope, you know, would like to stress that there are also things that cannot be transformed and losses that cannot be overcome because you know, life isn't that kind. But I think it's the balance, it's the interplay, really. It's the Caracuzzo of light and dark, the interchange between loss and discovery that I'm interested in.
Are you thinking of any particular character or episodes in the books which really demonstrates what you're just saying about loss that can't be overcome or transformed?
Well, I think that David McBride's an example. He doesn't get the romantic ending that some people feared I might be going to give him. Although I think anyone who's read my books will know I'm not very likely to do that.
You touch on it very delicately. There's that moment where he and Elizabeth are together looking at, I think it's the David
it's the
and
David.
Goliath, isn't
yeah.
it? And they see the possibility of putting their arms around each other and don't do it.
Well, of course, we don't even know if she does.
Don't you think so? When you give her at the very end the inscription in the book that she sends him from the story to Emmaus, "Were not our hearts burning within us?" Isn't that a reference to what she was feeling as well?
Well, now you're behaving like my favourite readers. You now know more about this book than I do, which is a moment I welcome because I can relax and leave it to them. You'd be amazed how many letters I get about Miss Garnett's ending. People anxious to reassure themselves it ends as they wish and not as it might do. So I'm going to remain agnostic about Elizabeth. I think one of the things, when I first wrote that book, it's the most worked over of my books. Of all the books I've written, it's the only one I really reworked. And the way in which I reworked it was I originally gave her a voice too.
The Other Side of You, this is
yes,
you're talking about.
Yes, The Other Side of You. I gave the voice, the narrator as it stands is David McBride, who is both a psychiatrist and a psychoanalyst. Initially, I gave the other voice to his patient, Elizabeth, And so it was his voice and then her voice. And when I'd got about two-thirds through, I decided that I didn't really... It wasn't I didn't like her voice, but it didn't ring as true to me, interestingly, as the male voice. And so I went back and took her story out as told by her and redid it as told by him, whereupon, understandably enough, the story changed. Because, you see, stories always change according to the teller, even if it's the same story, which is, I think, one of the points of a lot of my books, and particularly that one. And I think, you know, that moment, which for me is really the climax of the book, when they stand in the Villa Borghese looking at the painting of David, which is a marvellous portrait, which naturally enough has a great resonance for David McBride, because his name is David, and it has been referred to in their seven-hour conversation in quite a significant way. And he looks at the David with new eyes, which is another thing that I'm interested in, the way in which vision becomes revision according to our experiences. I decided I really didn't know what her response was or might have been, that I had to stick to my decision to do it only through his consciousness. And of course, we never really know another person. So you can think what you like. You're the romantic.
Okay, I'll be the romantic.
But I will say this. I think that he himself says... actually, do you have it? Because I will misremember it. I think Michael's probably got the tab.
It's the... Here's the Villa Borghese bit. Somewhere in there is the moment.
Yeah, it's in here. Yes, the note of anguish hung in the air like the after peal of the bells which had roused me from sleep that morning, or the motes in the sun's fingers. And she looked at me, and our eyes were full of tears. And the tears were the reciprocities of an understanding beyond words. I think that if I had walked towards her, she might have opened her arms to me, and perhaps we should have found another, better way of feeding our shared remorse. For a fraction of an interval, the possibility hovered between us, with the haunting words and the red-veined marble and the dusty sunlight and Caravaggio's brave self-portrait and the figure of the lonely boy and the timeless stories of death and loss and remorse which we had shared and would always share. And I knew, you're right, I'm wrong, and I knew she was involved in the same elusive, impossible calculation. And then the moment passed. And this is the bit I remember, interestingly. Maybe we had been through too much to accomplish a fresh beginning. Maybe we were too world-worn. Maybe I felt too much in the shadow of Thomas. Her story had restored the authentic likeness beneath the clumsy overlay. But that self would always be a hesitant one. It wasn't in me to embrace her high-hearted lover's blazing disregard for certainty. Now, you see, what's interesting is I remember that second paragraph, and you remember the first.
So, yes.
And that's the beauty of writing. Once you've done it, it goes into the world. And the characters are no longer yours. So, you know, what was there is there for other people to read and illuminate, I think.
Well, I've been having such a sense of encounter with something quite remarkable in your books, because preparing for this, I've read all of Sally's novels. And I can see that our 45 minutes is going to disappear before I've got near half the stuff that I really want to talk to you about.
Than the other, yes.
because there's a psychoanalytic therapeutic slant to the occasion, I do want to get on to the last two books where there's a particular emphasis on that. But before that, I just wanted to pick up something else about seeing. You yes. talked about the seeing and the looking, and of course, because it's Caravaggio paintings that particularly drive the other side of you, it's very visual. Mr. Golightly's Holiday was Sally's third novel. Do you remember the bit in that where Mr. Golightly looks at the spider's web?
Yes, I do remember that.
Would you like to...
You've struck lucky.
because... This is a description. I mean, I'm also very interested in the quality of Sally's writing. I think there's a particular change in it, which I'd like to ask you about if we get onto that. But I do think this is a beautiful description of a man who actually has a rather particular identity. Those of you who may have read the novel will know that this is not just an ordinary man, Mr. Golightly. He's looking at a spider's web. Would you like to read from there to there?
Ah, yes, this is where Mr. Golightly has come out of the church, isn't it? For the first time he's been in. Looking outside, he saw a spider's web, one of many whose delicate dentations decked the cottage windows. The spider spun its web simply to trap flies. But what was designed by nature for a natural function may take on more than nature's ends. The fragile structure had caught in its subtle mesh the drops of rain from a morning shower, and the diamond beads shone in the sun, fragments of some larger, profounder, more luminous light, reflecting the mysterious power of creation to recreate from its own forms an infinite scintillation of possibilities, possibilities which gestured at realms far beyond the demands of immediate survival. Why should that wholly practical, sticky emanation, devised by evolution to trap the food to fill the hungry spider's belly, be able also to catch the human imagination and draw in the impressionable heart? The power of the universe to create and ascend beyond itself was also part of the reality of things, every bit as real as the dead fly in the spider's maw. I'd forgotten it.
Thank you very much, Sally. It's that, I mean, you'll see what I mean about a particular quality of looking that's going on there. And what really struck me is that last sentence, the power of the universe to create and ascend beyond itself was also part of the reality of things. Mm. Now, what reality is something that comes through your writing, questions about what it really amounts to is very pervasive. But I wondered if you, I mean, I think it links to this theme of transformation. What do you mean by the power of the universe to ascend beyond itself?
Well, I mean, the spider's web is a very good example. The spider, presumably, you know, in a strict biological description of what it's doing when it spins a web, is using one particular physiological function in order to trap and find its own food. But the effect of the spider's web on the human eye is something rather different. And having affected the human eye in that way, it can then become transformed into a description, just a simple description, or a poem, or a story, or a painting, or whatsoever. And it seems to me that this whole element in human consciousness is one of the great mysteries that really has not been, fully understood, or even partly understood by anybody, the capacity of the human animal to extend its abilities beyond what is simply animal into an endless possibility of creation and recreation, of which art is one very obvious and noble example, but I think there are probably others that we can think of.
Well, another one must be love, wasn't it? Which is a theme that runs through all your books very, very powerfully. Miss Garnett discovering it in the instances of the number three, an extraordinary relationship developing between the wife of a man who's died and the man's mistress. A most unlikely relationship, but the things to do with what love means are explored there. And of course, the other side of you, which is all about love. And I think one of the most extraordinary things that you put into the mouth of any of your characters is another thing when Mr. Golightly is talking to Ellen Thomas, one of the subsidiary characters in Mr. Golightly's Holiday, who undergoes a very extraordinary transformation herself. She has a vision in which she is told to tell the world about love, and she has no idea how to do this and is kind of semi-destroyed psychologically by the dilemma of what it can mean to her, and then finds a way of discovering something new about it. And she and Mr. Golightly are having a conversation where she's saying, why on earth did this happen to me? Why me? And yes, she says, why me? What, for God's sake, do I know? Well, said Mr. Golightly, since you ask. And his gaze, with its peculiar shifting quality, which had bent on her with unusual directness, now settled again in the direction of the dark crows. I would say that perhaps what you know, it is a hard thing to explain, is that love is larger than life. I mean, that's, in one way or another, that's a sort of knockout remark, it seems to me. And I just wonder what you might be able to say about it.
Ah, oh, right. This is the moment where I say, well, this is why I write books, Michael. So I don't have to explain things. I have a habit...
I didn't ask you to explain it. No. I really was just asking you to free associate.
I know you didn't. It's interesting, you've picked out a number of passages which I remember as being important, and that is an important one, but I'd forgotten that's how he put it. And I do have a way of using these sorts of phrases, larger than life would be one, which I suppose is my way of not becoming too grandiose and inflated when I'm trying to talk about what I regard as important things. But yes, I suppose love is larger than life in that it takes us, it enables us to do things which offer serious challenges to our own safety and comfort. Often takes us into areas where we would probably, if we were in our right minds, not go, where we would often be warned it were better we didn't go. It is an extraordinary mystery and an extraordinary element, I think, of human consciousness, which cannot be explained on evolutionary lines. I mean, very simple forms of, rather obvious forms of love can be, but not the extraordinary polarity and polarity of love that the human animal is capable of. And I think exploring that in all sorts of different forms, not simply romantic love, but love between parent and child, love between people of the same sex, love between friends. I mean, one of my great delights is to take people... You seem to have rather settled on Mr. Golightly, which gives me great joy, because it's the oddest of my books, but there's a character in it called Paula, who is a barmaid who just sprung to life. And against all the odds and all my expectations becomes a great charm of Mr. Golightly, which is very amusing when you discover who he is. Well, it was amusing to me anyway. And there's a great love between them, for example. So I think that... I think I probably give romantic love rather a poor run for its money compared to other forms of love. It doesn't often do that well. Although I certainly deal with it.
Yes, yes. Since you're an ex-psychoanalyst and I'm a current psychoanalyst and there's a psychoanalytic subsidy to the evening, I think I've got a sort of duty to come on to the last novel particularly.
You make that sound very threatening. I quite like the last novel.
I'm very interested in something that happens, to my mind, in your writing towards the last novel.
Yes.
I think there's a distinct shift, and I'd be interested to know if you would recognise or agree with this, between the third one, Mr. Golightly, and the fourth one, The Other Side of You, and then more so still into Where Three Roads Meet. Your writing seems to become looser, more transparent, clearer somehow, as though you're moving towards something new in what you're doing as a writer.
I think that's true, though it wasn't consciously done. As I said, I think The Other Side of You was the book that's given me the most trouble. And, you know, rather like One's Troublesome Child, it turns out to be the one I love most for that reason. I did wrestle with it quite a lot, and I think in the course of that, perhaps it was the discipline of writing in a first-person voice, which is a different sort of a challenge. It's a more tricky thing to do because you can't so easily go off on one, you know. If you're writing third person, you can have passages of you know, rather lovely poetical prose. You're less able to do that if you're writing within the confines of a particular personality, although I did make the sensible step of having a personality who was rather literate. But I think you're right, and particularly in The Three Roads, which is all written in dialogue, which again I didn't intend, but it was the way the book turned out. There are only two characters in it. I think it is, the writing has got sparer and, well, I would hope more to the point. I don't know, I'm not the best judge of that, actually. It's something I would tend to rely on my readers more on picking up. But I think partly the topic, but possibly something happening inside me, because writing is an evolutionary process too. You know, you make mistakes, you learn from experiments. I'm against the current trend, which is, I'm afraid, made more prominent by the publishing business, which demands success of a successful writer. So once you've become a successful writer, you're on a sort of treadmill to repeat your success. Now, that's quite a difficult thing to do, because either you reproduce the same book, which is what they'd really like me to do. You know, they'd really like it very much if I wrote a sequel to Miss Garnett's Angel. Bring back Miss Garnett. I mean, I parody a bit, but either they want you to rewrite the same novel, or they want you to write another novel which is equally as good in a different genre. Well, you can't just do that without experimentation. So one of my great complaints is it's very difficult for, and I'm not just talking about myself, any writer nowadays, to try something out, perhaps get it a bit wrong, but do something more interesting with it the next time around. Because all the time, if you're going to grow, you're going to change, and therefore everything is going to be an experiment. And you can't tell whether it works or not until the book is out, and not until it's some time out as well, because the first reactions to a book are liable to be coloured by the books you've written before. So they're likely to disappoint some or enthuse others, not always for the right reasons, I think.
Mm. I'd certainly agree about the writing being sparer, and very effectively so, in Where Three Roads Meet. There's a lovely description, which we won't have time to hear, I'm afraid, the prophet Tiresias describing Delphi and what it feels like and means to him. And the economy of the writing there, I think, is very beautiful. What struck me particularly is that there's another change in the same place as the writing changes into novel number 4 and novel number 5. Those are the ones where the psychotherapy themes come out more directly into the open. psychotherapy has always been around in Sally's novels as a reference, occasionally direct, sometimes under the surface. There are some nice in-jokes in the second one, in instances of the number three. There is a chimney sweep who pretends to be a psychoanalyst, which is great fun when you remember Anna O telling Breuer that her therapy was like chimney sweeping. So we pick up these things. But it's not until The Other Side of You and Where Three Roads Meet that therapy and a book centered on Freud really come center stage. And I wondered whether you think that as you're settling more or discovering more your identity as a writer, the concerns that interested you and took you into being an analyst are becoming able to come back and be worked over again in this new sort of way.
Should we explain what Where Three Roads Meet is? It's a meeting between Freud in his last 16 months of his life, when he's, well, most of the action takes place then anyway. There's a little couple of episodes before then. When he's dying of the very painful and invasive cancer of the jaw that finally finished him, after he has left Vienna with the Nazi invasion. And while he is resting up, really, in his house in 20 Maresfield Gardens, which I'm sure almost everybody here knows is now the Freud Museum, where this book is set, he's visited by a stranger, and the stranger turns out to be Tiresias the Blind Seer, who is the character in the original Oedipus story, who knows the truth about Oedipus's past but is reluctant to tell him of it. And what I do is I have Tiresias come to tell Freud, the architect of the Oedipus complex, how it really was. So I had great fun with it, as well as other things. But to go back to Michael's question, I think that I've always been very concerned not to write about, now this sounds a bit odd, about too much about personal concerns in the things I write about. Now, I don't mean that I only write about things I'm not interested in. That would be completely balmy. But I don't want to be sort of banging drums and peddling lines. And so I think I steered clear of the profession I'd just come out of until I was far enough away from it to treat it as part of a whole body of experience and material that I had within me and had, I suppose, properly chewed it up and digested it. Because one of the things people sometimes ask me about research, they say, do you do a lot of research? And, you know, my humorous answer to that is that, like Anthony Burgess, my idea of research is a cup of coffee and another cigarette, which isn't strictly true, but it's a good answer to wriggle out of the question. But I don't do a lot of research, as it happens, except on place, where I'm pretty punctilious. I don't think anyone has spotted a flaw yet in the descriptions of the places where I've set the books. I know Delphi very well, and part of this book, as well as being set in Hampstead, is set in Delphi, where the Oracle was and where Tiresias worked. Venice, Miss Garnet, Rome, the other side of you, and so forth. So I'm very punctilious about place, but I don't like to do research. And the reason for that is, not that I'm especially against research, but I think that I can always tell, I believe, when I read a book in which an author has gone away and boned up on something. It, to me, sort of lies rather obviously on top of the written word. And for myself, I prefer something to come out without me popping off to look it up in the London Library all the time. I don't mean I don't check things. I do. I do often pick things up and go on and read up a bit more about them and pursue lines. I did with the Book of Tobit. But I already knew the Book of Tobit very well. I taught it. I knew quite a bit about the life of Freud, obviously, and quite a bit about his theories, although not as much as I thought I knew until I read it again to write the book. But I think that I didn't have to read up about the whole process of conducting an analysis, because I've done that from both sides. And therefore, it felt easy for me to do it. And I felt I could, you know, I always know, and I'm sure you do, when you read a book about a psychoanalyst, oh, that wouldn't have happened. Usually, because it's too correct.